One guest, reading a magazine, sat in a nearby chair, and even though he was the only guy in the room, it took me a second glance to realize that he was Vince. Vince set the magazine aside and ambled over to us. His unremarkable brown eyes scanned over Murphy. He nodded to her and offered me his hand. I shook it and offered a check to him with my left as we did. He took it, glanced at it noncommittally, and put it away in a pocket. "He took an elevator to the 12th floor," Vince said. "He's in room 1233. I blinked at him. "How the hell did you get that? Right up with him?" "Good way for me to get hurt. I stayed down here." He shrugged. "You said he was trouble." "He is. How'd you do it?" He gave me a bland look. "I'm good at this. You need to know which chair he's in, too?" "No, that's close enough," I said. Vince looked at Murphy again, frowned, and then frowned at me. "Jesus," he said. "You two look pretty serious." "Yeah," I said. "I told you, this guy's dangerous."
"He have anyone with him?"
"One person," he said. "A woman, I think." Murphy suddenly smiled. "How the hell do you know that?" I asked him. "Room service," she said. Vince smiled in faint approval at Murphy and nodded his head. "Could have been someone else on 12 who ordered champagne and 2 glasses 2 minutes after he got off the elevator, but this late at night, I doubt it." Vince glanced at me. "I'll take the bill I duped the steward out of my fee."
"Appreciated," I said.
He shrugged.
"That it?"
"Yeah.
Thanks, Vince."
"Long as the check clears," he said. "You're welcome." He nodded to me, to Murphy, and walked out of the hotel. Murphy eyed me after Vince left and smiled. "The mighty Harry Dresden, subcontracting detective work."
"They're expecting me to be all magic-y and stuff," I said, and I gave them what they expected to see. Binder wouldn't have been looking for someone like Vince.
"You're just annoyed because they pulled that trick on you," Murphy said, "and you're taking your vengeance."
I sniffed.
"I like to think of it as symmetry."
"That does make it sound nobler," she said.
"We obviously can't just go up there and haul him off somewhere for questioning. What's the plan?"
"Get more information," I said. "I'm gonna listen in and see what they're chatting about."
Murphy nodded, glancing around.
"Hotel security is going to have an issue with you lurking about the hallways."
"I'll go have a word with them."
I nodded.
"I'll be on 12.
"Don't kick down any doors without someone to watch your back," she warned me.
"No kicking at all," I said. "Not until I know enough to kick them where it's going to hurt." I went up to the 12th floor, left the elevator, and pulled a can of silly string out of my duster pocket. I shook it up as I walked down the hallway until I found room 1233. Then, without preamble, I blasted a bit of the silly string at the door. It slithered cheerfully through the air and stuck. Then I turned and walked back down the hall until I found a door that opened onto a tiny room containing an ice dispenser and a couple of vending machines. I sat down, drew a quick circle around me on the tile floor with a dry erase marker, and got to work. I closed the circle with an effort of will, and it sprang up around me in a sudden invisible screen. It wasn't exactly a heavy-duty magical construct, but such a quick circle would still serve perfectly well to seal away external energies and allow me to gather my own and shape it for a specific purpose without interference. I took the silly string and sprayed a bunch of it into the palm of my left hand so that it mounded up sort of like shaving cream. Then I set the can down, held the mound of silly string out in front of me, closed my eyes, and gathered my will. Working magic is all about creating connections. Earlier, I'd taken Binder's hairs to create a link back to him and used it for a tracking spell. I could have done any number of things with that connection, including some that were extremely nasty and dangerous. I'd seen it happen before, generally from the receiving end. This time, I was creating a link between the silly string in my hand and the bit stuck to the door down the hall. They'd both come from the same can, and they'd been part of one distinct amount of liquid when they'd been canned. That meant I would be able to take advantage of that sameness and create a connection between them. I focused my will on my desired outcome, gathered it all up together, and released it with a murmur of "Feniculus sonitus." I reached out and smeared away a section of the circle I'd drawn, breaking it, and instantly began feeling a buzzing vibration in the palm of my left hand. Then I tilted my head far to my right and slapped a bunch of silly string into my left ear. "Don't try this at home, folks," I muttered. "I'm a professional." The first thing I heard was hectic-sounding, hyperactive music. A singer was screaming tunelessly, and drums were pounding, and someone was either playing electric guitars or slowly dipping partially laryngitic cats in boiling oil. None of the supposed musicians appeared to be paying attention to anything anyone else in the band was doing. "Christ," came Binder's accented voice. "Not even you could dance to that tripe." There was a low-throated female laugh, and a slurred and very happy-sounding Madeline Wraith replied. "This music isn't about skill and precision, my sweet. It's about hunger and passion, and I could dance to it to make your eyes fall out." "I'm not your sweet," Binder said, his voice annoyed. "I am not your anything, Dux, excepting your contracted employee."
"I'm not sure I'd emphasize that if I were you, Binder," Madeline said, "since you've been a crushing disappointment as a hireling."
"I told you when I got started that if anyone from the White Council showed up, I couldn't make you any promises," he shot back, his voice annoyed. "And lo and behold, what happens? That buggering lunatic Harry Dresden shows up with backup, and with the support of a local constabulary to boot."
"I'm getting so sick of this," Madeline said. "He's only one man."
"One bloody member of the White Bloody Council," Binder countered. "Bear in mind that someone like him can do everything I can do, and considerable besides. And even people on the Bloody Council are nervous about that one."
"Well, I'm sick of him," spat Madeline. "Did you find out where he's got Morgan hidden?"
"Maybe you didn't hear, love, but I spent my day chained to a chair getting popped in the mouth."
Madeline laughed, a cold, mocking sound.
"There are places you'd have to pay for that."
"Not bloody likely."
"Did you find Morgan?"
Binder growled.
"Dresden had him stashed in rental storage for a bit, but he haired off before the cops could pick him up. Probably took him into the Never Never. They could be anywhere."
"Not if Dresden is back in Chicago," Madeline said. "He'd never let himself be too far from Morgan."
"So check his bloody apartment," Binder said.
"Don't be an idiot," Madeline said. "That's the first place anyone would look. He's not a total moron."
"Yeah, I wasn't."
"Ahem."
Binder snickered.
"Your money, Rafe. Money never really gets it."
Madeline's voice turned waspish.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"That not everyone has a bloody string of mansions around the world that they live in, or extra cars that they never really drive, or cash enough to not think twice about dropping $200 on a bottle of $40 room service champagne."
"So?"
"So? Dresden's a bloody kid by council standards. Lives in that crappy little hole, and pays for an office for his business to boot. He ain't had a century or two of compounded interest to shore up his accounts now, has he? And when he set himself up an emergency retreat, did he buy himself a furnished condo in another town? No. He rents out a cruddy little storage unit and stacks some camping gear inside."
"All right," Madeline said, her tone impatient. "Suppose you're right. Suppose he's got Morgan at his apartment. He won't have left him unprotected."
"Naturally not," Binder replied. "He'll have a bloody minefield of wards around the place. Might have some conjured guardians or some such as well."
"Could you get through them?"
"Give me enough time and enough of my lads, and yeah," he said. "But it wouldn't be quick, quiet, or clean. There's a simpler way."
"Which is?"
"Burn the bloody place down," Binder said promptly. "The apartment's got one door. If Morgan comes scurrying out, we bag him. If not, we collect his bones after the ashes cool. Identify him with dental records or something and claim the reward."
I felt a little bit sick to my stomach. Binder was way too perceptive for my comfort level. The guy might not be overly smart, but he was more than a little cunning. His plan was pretty much exactly the best way to attack my apartment, defensive magics notwithstanding. What's more, I knew he was capable of actually doing it. It would kill my elderly neighbors, the other residents of the building, but that wouldn't slow someone like Binder down for half a second.
No, Madeline said after a tense moment of silence. I have my instructions. If we can't take him ourselves, we at least see to it that the wardens find him.
The wardens have found him, Binder complained. Dresden's a bloody warden. Your boss should have paid up already.
There was a quiet, deadly silence, and then Madeline purred.
You've been modestly helpful to him in the past, Binder, but don't start thinking that you would survive telling him what he should or should not do. The moment you become more annoying than useful, you are a dead man.
No sin to want money, Binder said sullenly. I did my part to get it.
No, Madeline said. You lost a fight to one overgrown Boy Scout and one pint-sized mortal woman, got yourself locked up by the police, of all the ridiculous things, and missed your chance to earn the reward.
Sheets rustled, and soft footsteps whispered on the carpet. A moment later, a lighter flicked. Madeline smoked.
Binder spoke again, in a tone of voice that indicated he was changing the topic of conversation.
You going to clean that up?
That's exactly why it's there, Madeline said. She took a drag and said, cleaning up. It's too bad you didn't get here 5 minutes sooner.
And why is that?
Because I probably would have waited to make the call. I felt myself leaning forward slightly and holding my breath.
What call? Binder said.
To the wardens, naturally, Madeline said. I told them that Morgan was in town and that Dresden was sheltering him. They should be here within the hour.
I felt my mouth drop open and my stomach did a cartwheeling backflip with an integrated quadruple axle.
Oh, crap.
Chapter 33. Murphy looked at the rolls and said,
You're kidding.
We'd driven down to the sack separately, and she hadn't seen the wheels I was using. I was parked closer to the hotel, so we were about to get into the Silver Wraith together.
It's a loner, I said. Get in.
I am not a material girl, she said, running a hand over the Rolls' fender, but damn.
Can we focus here, I said. The world's coming to an end.
Murphy shook her head and then got in the car with me.
Well, at least you're going out in style.
I got the Rolls moving. It got plenty of looks, even in the dead of night, and the other motorists out so late gave it a generous amount of room, as if intimidated by the Wraith's sheer artistry.
Actually, I said, I'm kind of finding the Rolls to be irrationally comforting.
Murphy glanced aside at me.
Why's that?
I know how I'm going to die, you know? One of these days, maybe real soon, I'm going to find out I've bitten off more than I can chew. I swallowed. I mean, I just can't keep from sticking my nose in places people don't want it. And I always figured it would be the council who punched my ticket, regardless of who believed what about me, because there's a bunch of assholes there, and I just can't let them wallow in their own bull and pretend it's an air of nobility.
Murphy's expression became more sober. She listened in silence.
Now the council's coming, and they've got good reason to take me out. Or it looks like it to them, which is the same thing.
I swallowed again. My mouth felt dry.
But I somehow just have the feeling that when I go out, it isn't going to be in style. I gestured at the Rolls with a vague sweep of one hand. This just isn't the car I drive to my death, you know?
Murph's mouth tucked up at one corner, though most of the smile was in her eyes. She took my hand between hers and held it. Her hands felt very warm. Maybe mine were just cold.
You're right, of course, Harry.
You think?
Definitely, she said. This car just isn't you. You'll die in some badly painted, hideously recycled piece of junk that seems to keep on running despite the laws of physics that say it should be melted scrap by now.
Phew, I said. I thought I might be the only one who thought that.
Her fingers tightened on mine for a moment, and I clung back. The council was coming, and there wasn't anything I could do to fight them. Oh, sure, maybe I could poke someone in the nose and run, but they would catch up to me sooner or later. There would be more of them than me, some of them every bit as strong as I was, and all of them dangerous. It might take a day, or a week, or a couple of weeks, but I had to sleep sooner or later. They'd wear me down. And that pissed me off. My sheer helplessness in the face of this whole stupid mess was infuriating. It wasn't as if I didn't have options. Mab still held a job offer open to me, for example. And it was more than possible that Lara Wraith might have the resources to shield me or broker me a better deal than the council was going to offer. When I thought of how unfair the whole thing was, I had more than a passing desire to grab whatever slender threads I could reach until I could sort things out later. Put that way, it almost sounded reasonable, noble even. I would, after all, be protecting other wrongly persecuted victims of the Council who littered the theoretical landscape of the future. It didn't sound nearly so much like entering bargains that went against everything I believed so that I could forcibly impose my will over those who were against me. I knew the truth, but just because it was true didn't make it any less tempting. What the hell was I going to do? I had a hidey hole planned out, but it had already been compromised. There was nowhere even a little bit safe I could take Morgan but my apartment, and the wardens were going to find him there. And on top of all that, I still had no freaking clue as to the identity of our mysterious puppet master. Maybe it was time to admit it. This one was too big for me. It had been from the very start. "Murph," I said quietly, "I don't know how I'm going to get out of this." Silence filled the beautiful old car. "When's the last time you slept?" Murphy asked. I had to take my hand back from hers to shift gears. I gestured at my bandaged head. "I can barely remember what day of the week it is. This morning, a couple of hours, I think." She nodded judiciously. "You know what your problem is." I eyed her and then started laughing, or at least making an amused wheezing sound. I couldn't help it. "Problem, singular," I choked out finally. "No, what?" "You like to come off like you're the unpredictable chaos factor in any given situation. But at the end of the day, you obsess about having everything ordered the way you want it. Have you seen my lab?" "Again with the inappropriately timed come-ons," Murphy said. "I'm serious, Harry. I know some people who would really disagree with you, like what's-his-face, Peabody." "He's counsel?" "Yeah, says I have no place in his bastion of order." She smirked. "The problem is that your bastion of order is sort of tough to coexist with. I have no bastions. I am bastionless." "Ha," Murphy said. "You like the same car, the same apartment, the same restaurant. You like not needing to answer to anyone and doing the jobs your conscience dictates you should do without worrying about the broader issues they involve. You hang out fairly happily without much in the way of material wealth and follow your instincts and be damned to anyone who tells you otherwise. That's your order." I eyed her. "Is there some other way it should be?" She rolled her eyes. "I rest my case." "And how is this my problem?" "You've never really compromised your order for someone else's, which is why you drive the wardens nuts. They have procedures, they have forms, they have reports, and you ignore them unless someone twists your arm to make you do it. Am I right?" "Still don't see how that's a problem." She rolled down the passenger side window and let one hand hang out. "It's a problem because you never learned how to adjust inside someone else's order," she said. "If you had, you'd realize what an incredible force you have working on your side."
"The A-team?"
"Bureaucracy," Murphy said. "I would rather have the A-team." "Listen and learn, Maverick," Murphy said. "The wardens are an organization, right?"
"Yeah."
"Lots of members?"
"Almost 300 and growing," I said.
"Lots of members who all have many obligations, who live in different areas, who speak different languages, but who have to communicate and work together somehow."
"Yeah."
"Behold," Murphy said, "bureaucracy. Organization to combat the entropy that naturally inhibits that kind of cooperative effort."
Is there gonna be a quiz later, or...
She ignored me. Bureaucracies share common traits, and I think you've got more time to move in than you realize. If you weren't tired and hurting and an obnoxious fly in the ointment to anyone's order but your own, you'd see that.
I frowned. How so?
Do you think Madeline Wraith called up the White Council on her home phone, identified herself, and just told them you were helping Morgan?
Murphy shook her head.
Hello, I'm the enemy. Let me help you for no good reason.
I sucked thoughtfully on my lower lip. The wardens would probably assume she was trying to divert their resources during a manpower-critical situation.
Murphy nodded. And while they will look into it, they'll never really believe it, and it will go straight to the bottom of their priority list.
So she calls in an anonymous tip instead, so?
So how many tips do you think the wardens have gotten? Murphy asked.
Cops go through the same thing.
Some big flashy crime goes down and we have a dozen nuts claiming credit or convinced their neighbor did it, another dozen jerks who want to get their neighbor in trouble, and three times that many well-meaning people who have no clue whatsoever and think they're helping.
I chewed on that thought for a moment. Murphy wasn't far off the mark. There were plenty of organizations and Lord only knew how many individuals who would want to stay on the warden's good side. Or who would want to impress them, or who would simply want to have a real reason to interact with them.
Murph was probably right. There probably were tips flooding in from all over the world.
They'll check the tip out, Murphy said. But I'm willing to bet you real money that, depending on their manpower issues, it won't happen until several hours after the tip actually makes it into the hands of the folks running the show. And with any luck, given the council's issues with technology and communication, that will take a while as well.
I mulled that one over for a minute.
What are you saying?
She put her hand on my arm and squeezed once.
I'm saying don't give up yet. There's still a little time.
I turned my head and studied Murphy's profile for a moment.
Really?
I asked her quietly.
She nodded.
Yeah.
Like love... Hope is one of those ridiculously disproportional words that by all rights should be a lot longer.
I resettled my grip on the roll's steering wheel.
Murph?
Hmm?
You're one hell of a dame.
Sexist pig, she said.
She smiled out the windshield.
Don't make me hurt you.
Yeah, I said. It wouldn't be ladylike.
She shook her head as we neared my apartment.
If you like, she said, take him to my place. You can hide out there.
I didn't actually smile, but her words made me feel like doing it.
Not this time. The wardens know where you live, remember? If they start looking hard at me...
They'll check me out too, Murphy said.
But you can't keep him at your place.
I know that. I also know that I can't drag anyone else into the middle of this cluster... this mess.
There's gotta be somewhere, she said. Someplace quiet and not well known. And away from crowds, she paused. And where you can protect him from tracking magic. And where you'd have the advantage if it did come to a fight.
I didn't say anything.
Okay, Murphy said. I guess maybe there aren't any places like that around here.
I snapped my head up straight.
Hell's bells, I breathed.
I felt a grin stretch my mouth.
I think maybe there is.
Chapter 34. I came through my apartment door, took one look around the candlelit place, and half shouted,
"Hell's bells! What is wrong with you people?"
Morgan sat slumped against the wall with the fireplace, and fresh spots of blood showed through his bandages. His eyes were only partly open. His hand lay on the floor beside him, limp, the fingers half curled. A tiny little semi-automatic pistol lay on the floor beneath his hand. It wasn't mine. I have no idea where he'd been hiding it. Molly was on the floor in front of the sofa, with Mouse literally sitting on her back. She was heaving breaths in and out, making the big dog rise and settle slightly as she did. Lucio lay where I'd left her on the couch, flat on her back, her eyes closed, obviously still unconscious. Mouse had one of his paws resting lightly on her sternum. Given the nature of her recent injury, it seemed obvious that he would need to exert minimal pressure on her to immobilize her with pain should she awaken. The air smelled of cordite. Mouse's fur, all down his left foreleg, was matted and caked with blood. When I saw that, I rounded on Morgan in a fury, and if Murphy hadn't stepped forward and grabbed my arm with both hands, I would have started kicking his head flat against my wall. I settled for kicking the gun away instead. If I got a couple of his fingers, too, it didn't bother me much at the time. Morgan watched me with dull, hardly conscious eyes. "I swear," I snarled. "I swear to God, Morgan, if you don't explain yourself, I'm going to strangle you dead with my own hands and drag your corpse back to Edinburgh by the balls." "Harry," Murphy shouted, and I realized that she had positioned her entire body between me and Morgan, and she was leaning against me like a soldier struggling to raise a flag. Morgan bared his teeth, more rictus than smile. "Your warlock," he said, his voice dry and leathery, "was trying to enter Captain Lucio's mind against her will." I surged forward, and Murphy pushed me back again. I weighed twice what she did, but she had good leverage and focus. "And so you shot my dog?" I screamed. "He interposed himself," Morgan said. He coughed weakly and closed his eyes, his face turning grayer. "Never meant to hit." "I swear to God," I snarled. "That's it. That is it. Molly and I are going right to the wall for you, and this is how you repay us? I am pushing your paranoid ass out my door, leaving you there, and starting a pool on who comes for you first. The Black Council, the Wardens, or the goddamn buzzards?"
Harry?"
Molly said in a weak, nauseated and shamed voice, barely more than a whisper. I felt my anger abruptly drain away, to be replaced by a wave of denial and a slowly dawning sense of horror. I turned, slowly, to look at Molly.
"He was right,"
she wheezed, not looking at me, struggling to speak over the burden of Mouse's weight. I could hear the tears reflected in her voice as they began to fall.
"I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, Harry. He was right."
I leaned my shoulders back against the wall and watched as Mouse looked at me with grave, pained eyes and stayed right where he was, both holding Molly down and shielding her body with his. We got Morgan put back into bed, and then I went over to Mouse. "Okay," I said, "move." Only then did Mouse remove himself from Molly's back, limping heavily to one side. I knelt down by him and examined his leg. He flattened his ears and leaned away from me. I said firmly, "Stop that. Hold still." Mouse sighed and looked miserable, but he let me poke at his leg. I found the wound up near his shoulder and a hard lump under the skin. "Get up," I said to Molly, my tone steady. "Go to the lab. Get the medical kit under the table. Then get the little scissors and a fresh razor from the cabinet in my bathroom." She pushed herself up slowly. "Move," I said, my voice quiet and level and unyielding. She was obviously still recovering from being pinned to the floor, but she moved quicker and staggered down to my lab. Murphy knelt down next to me and ruffled Mouse's ears. He gave her a miserable look. She held up Morgan's gun. "25 caliber," she said. "Big as he is, wouldn't have been easy to kill him with it, even on purpose." She shook her head. "Or Molly, for that matter." "Meaning what?" I asked her. "Meaning maybe Morgan didn't intend the attack to be lethal. Maybe he used the smaller weapon for that reason." "He used the smaller weapon because it was the only one he had," I said, my voice harsh. "He'd have killed Molly if he could have." Murphy was quiet for a moment before she said, "That's attempted murder." I glanced up at her for a second, then I said, "You want to arrest him?" "It isn't an issue of what I want," she said. "I'm an officer of the law, Harry." I thought about that for a moment. "The council might..." "They might respect it," I said quietly. "In fact, I'm certain they would." "It would be the Merlin's call,"
and he'd love nothing better than to buy more time to work out how to get Morgan out of this mess. But others wouldn't, she said.
Madeline and Shagnasty sure wouldn't, I said. And if Morgan's in jail, there's no way to force Shagnasty into a confrontation where I have a chance to take Thomas back. I looked at Mouse's wound. Or trade him.
You'd do that? She asked.
Morgan? For Thomas? I shook my head. Hell's bells, it would make a mess. The council would go berserk, but
Thomas was my brother. I didn't say it. I didn't need to.
Murphy nodded. Molly reappeared with the things I'd sent her for, plus a bowl and a pair of needle-nose pliers. Smart girl. She poured rubbing alcohol into a bowl and started sterilizing the suture needle, the thread, the scalpel, and the pliers. Her hands moved like they knew what they were doing without need for her to consciously direct them. That probably shouldn't have surprised me. Michael and Charity Carpenter's eldest daughter had probably been taught to deal with injuries since the time she was physically large enough to do so.
Mouse, I said, there's a bullet inside you. Do you know what that is? The thing that a gun shoots that hurts?
Mouse looked at me uncertainly. He was shaking. I put my hand on his head and spoke steadily.
We've got to take it out of you or it could kill you. It's going to hurt. A lot. But I promise you that it won't take long, and that you're going to be all right. I'll protect you, okay?
Mouse made a very soft noise that only the ungracious would have called a whine. He leaned his head against my hand, trembled, and then very slowly licked my hand once. I smiled at him and leaned my head against his for a second.
It will be all right. Lie down, boy.
Mouse did, stretching slowly, carefully out on his side, the wounded shoulder up.
Here, Harry, Molly said quietly, gesturing at the tools.
I looked at her, my face hard.
You're doing it.
She blinked at me.
What?
But what I did, I don't even...
I? Mouse just took a bullet for you, Miss Carpenter, I said, my words precise. He wasn't thinking of himself when he did it. He was putting his life at risk to protect you. If you want to remain my apprentice, you will stop saying sentences that begin with I and repay his courage by easing his pain.
Her face went white.
Harry?
I ignored her and moved around to kneel by Mouse's head, holding him down gently, stroking my hands over his thick fur. My apprentice looked from me to Murphy, her expression uncertain. Sergeant Murphy stared back at her with calm cop eyes, and Molly averted her gaze hurriedly. She looked from her own hands to Mouse and started crying. Then she got up, went to the kitchen sink, and put a pot of water on the stove to boil. She washed her hands carefully, all the way to the elbow. Then she came back with the water, took a deep breath, and settled down beside the wounded dog, taking up the instruments. She cut and shaved the area around the injury first, making Mouse flinch and quiver several times. I saw her cringe at each pained movement from the dog, but her hands stayed steady. She had to widen the tear in the dog's flesh with a scalpel. Mouse actually cried out when the knife cut him, and she closed her eyes tight for a long count of three before she went back to work. She slid the pliers into the shallow injury and pulled out the bullet. It was a tiny thing, smaller than the nail on the end of my pinky, a distorted, oblong bit of shiny metal. Mouse groaned as she tugged it free. She cleaned the side of the wound again, using the boiled water and disinfectant. Mouse flinched and cried out when she did so, the most agonized sound I had ever heard him make.
"I'm sorry," Molly said, blinking tears out of the way. I'm sorry.
The injury was big enough to need a trio of stitches. Molly did them as swiftly as she possibly could, drawing more shudders of pain from Mouse. Then she cleaned the site again and covered it with a small pad that she cut to the proper size, affixing it to the bare-shaved skin around the injury with medical tape.
There, she said quietly.
She leaned down and buried her face in the thick ruff of fur around Mouse's throat.
There. You'll be all right.
Mouse moved very gingerly, moving his head to nudge against her hand. His tail thumped several times on the floor.
"Murph," I said, "give us a minute."
"Sure," she said quietly. "I need to make a call anyway." She nodded to me and walked quietly to the apartment door, pointedly pausing to close the door from the living room to my small bedroom, shutting Morgan out of the conversation. I sat with Mouse, stroking his head gently.
"Okay," I said to Molly. "What happened?"
She sat up and looked at me. She looked like she wanted to throw up. Her nose was running now.
It occurred to me, Harry, that, well, if the traitor wanted to really set the council at one another's throats, the best way to do it would be to force one of them to do something unforgivable, like maybe force Morgan to kill Wizard Lafortier.
"Gee," I said, "that never once occurred to me, though I am older and wiser than you and have been doing this for most of your life, whereas you've been in the business for just under 4 years.
She flushed. "Yes. Well, then I thought that the best way to use that sort of influence wouldn't be to use it on Morgan," she said, "but on the people who would be after him."
I lifted my eyebrows. "Okay," I said. "At this point, I have to ask you if you know how difficult it is to manipulate the mind and will of anyone of significant age. Most wizards who are 80 or 100 years old are generally considered more or less immune to that kind of gross manipulation."
"I didn't know that," Molly said humbly. "But what I'm talking about wouldn't be a severe alteration to anyone. It wouldn't be obvious," she said. "You wouldn't make someone turn into a raving lunatic and murderer. I mean, that's sort of noticeable. Instead, you make sure that you just sort of nudge the people who are chasing after Morgan into being a little bit more like what you want them to be."
I narrowed my eyes. It was an interesting line of thought.
"Such as?"
"Well," she said, "if someone is naturally quick to anger and prone to fighting, you highlight that part of their personality. You give it more importance than it would have without intervention. If someone is prone to maneuvering politically to take advantage of a situation, you bring that to the forefront of their personality. If someone is nursing a grudge, you shine a spotlight on it in their thoughts, their emotions, to get them to act on it."
I thought about that one for a second.
"It's how I'd do it," Molly said quietly, lowering her eyes. I looked at the young woman I'd been teaching. When I saw Molly, I always saw her smile, her sense of humor, her youth, and her joy. She was the daughter of a close friend. I knew her family and was often a guest in their home. I saw my apprentice, the effort she put into learning, her frustrations, and her triumphs. I had never, until that very moment, thought of her as someone who might one day be a very, very scary individual. I found myself smiling bitterly. Who was I to throw stones?
"Maybe," I said finally. "It would be one hell of a difficult thing to prove."
She nodded. "But if it was going to be used, there's one person who would without doubt be a target." I glanced at Lucio. Her mouth was open slightly as she slept. She was drooling a little. It was ridiculous and adorable.
"Yeah," Molly said, "but she would never have let me look. You know she wouldn't have."
"For good reason," I said. Molly's jaw tensed up for a second.
"I know."
"So you thought you'd look while everyone was unconscious," I said, "when you wouldn't get caught." She shrugged her shoulders. "You told yourself that you were doing the right thing," I said, "just a peek, in and out." She closed her eyes.
"I was... Harry, what if she isn't being honest with you? What if all this time she's been getting close to you because she doesn't trust you? What if she's just like Morgan, only a lot better at hiding it?"
"You don't know what you're talking about," I said.
"No?" She met my eyes. "Whose apprentice was he, Harry? Who taught him to be the way he is? Who did he idolize so much that he modeled himself after her?
I just sat there for a second. Molly pressed the issue.
Do you honestly think that she never knew how Morgan treated you?
I took a deep breath. Then I said, yeah, I think that.
She shook her head.
You know better.
No, I said, I don't.
You should, she said fiercely.
I couldn't take the chance that she would let you go down with Morgan. I had to know.
I stared at her for a minute. Then I said, in a very quiet voice, I always know when I'm being tempted to do something very, very wrong. I start sentences with phrases like, I would never, ever do this, but, or I know this is wrong, but. It's the but that tips you off.
Harry, Molly began, you broke one of the laws of magic, Molly, willfully, even though you knew it could cost you your life, even though you knew that it could also cost mine.
I shook my head and looked away from her.
Hell's bells, kid.
I choose to trust Anastasia Lucio because that's what people do. You don't ever get to know for sure what someone thinks of you, what they really feel inside.
But I could.
No, I said gently. Even psychomancy doesn't give you everything. We aren't meant to know what's going on in there. That's what talking is for. That's what trust is for.
Harry, I'm so-
I lifted a hand. Don't apologize. Maybe I'm the one who let you down. Maybe I should have taught you better. I petted Mouse's head, gently looking away from her. It doesn't matter at the moment. People have died because I've been trying to save Morgan's life. Thomas might still die. And now, if we do manage to save Morgan's crusty old ass, he's going to report that you violated your parole. The council will kill you. And me. She stared at me helplessly.
I didn't mean to
get caught, I said quietly.
Jesus Christ, kid. I trusted you.
She wept more heavily now. Her face was a mess. She bowed her head. If Morgan goes down for this, I said, there's going to be trouble like you wouldn't believe, and even more people are going to die. I stood up slowly. So, I'm going to do everything in my power to save him. She nodded without looking up. So you've got a choice to make, Grasshopper. You can come with me, knowing the cost if we succeed, or you can go.
Go?
She whispered. Go, I said. Leave now. Run, for as long as you can. Hell, it looks a lot like I'm going to get myself killed anyway. Probably Morgan, too. In that case, things will go to hell, but the wardens will be way too busy to chase you. You'll be able to ignore what's right all you want. Do whatever you like, as long as you don't get caught. She pressed her arms against her stomach. She sounded like she was about to throw up through the sobs. I put a hand on her head and said, or you can come with me. You can do something right. Something that has meaning. She looked up at me, her lovely young face discolored in anguish. Everyone dies, honey, I said very quietly. Everyone. There's no if, there's only when. I let that sink in for a moment. When you die, do you want to feel ashamed of what you've done with your life? Feel ashamed of what your life meant? She stared at my eyes for a minute and a half of silence, broken only by the sound of her muted weeping, and her head twitched in a single, tiny shake. I promise that I'll be beside you, I said. I can't promise anything else, only that I'll stand beside you for as long as I can.
Okay,
she whispered. She leaned against me. I put my hand on her hair for a minute, then I said gently, we're out of time. The wardens will know Morgan is in Chicago within a few hours at most. They might be on their way already.
Okay, she said. Well, what are we going to do?
I took a deep breath.
Among other things, I'm going to attempt a sanctum invocation, I said.
Her eyes widened.
But you said that kind of thing was dangerous, that only a fool would take such a chance.
I agreed to help Donald freaking Morgan when he showed up at my door, I sighed. I qualify.
She wiped at her eyes and nose. What do I do?
Get my ritual box. Put it in the car Murphy's cuddling up with outside.
Okay, Molly said.
She turned away, but then paused and looked back over her shoulder at me.
Harry?
Yeah.
I know it was wrong, but...
I looked at her sharply and frowned. She shook her head and held up her hands.
Hear me out. I know it was wrong, and I didn't get much of a look, but... I swear to you, I think someone has tampered with Captain Lucio. I'd bet my life on it.
I ignored the little chill that danced down my spine.
Could be that you have, I said quietly, and mine, too.
Go get the box. Molly hurried to comply. I waited until she was outside to look at Mouse. The big dog sat up, his eyes gravely concerned. He wasn't favoring his shoulder at all, and his movement was completely unimpaired. Mouse got hit by the driver of a minivan once. He got back up, ran it down, and returned the favor. The foo dog was very, very tough. I doubted he'd really needed the medical attention to recover, though I was also sure it would help speed things along. But I hadn't been completely certain the injury wasn't as serious as it looked. In other words, the freaking dog had fooled Molly and me both.
You were acting, I said, to make it hit Molly harder?
His tail wagged back and forth proudly.
Damn, I said, impressed.
Maybe I should have named you Denzel. His jaws opened in a doggy grin. Earlier tonight, I said, when I was trying to figure out how to find Thomas, you interrupted me.
I didn't think about it before now, but you helped him track me down when Madrigal Wraith was auctioning me off on eBay.
His tail wagged harder.
Could you find Thomas?
Woof, he said, and his front paws bounced a couple of inches off the floor. I nodded slowly, thinking. And then I said,
I've got another mission for you, one that could be more important. You game?
He shook his fur out and padded to the door. Then he stopped and looked back over his shoulder at me.
Okay, I told him, walking to the door myself. Listen up. Things are about to get sort of risky.
Chapter 35. I looked at Lucio's still unconscious form. The stress of coordinating the search for Morgan for who knows how long before he showed up, coupled with the pains of her injuries and the sedative effect of the painkillers I'd given her, meant that she'd never stirred. Not when the gun went off, not when we'd been talking, and not when we'd all had to work together to get Morgan back up the stairs and out to the silver rolls. I made sure she was covered with a blanket. The moment I did, Mister descended from his perch atop one of my bookcases and draped himself languidly over her lower legs, purring. I scratched my cat's ears and said, "Keep her company." He gave me an inscrutable look that said maybe he would and maybe he wouldn't. Mister was a cat, and cats generally considered it the obligation of the universe to provide shelter, sustenance, and amusement as required. I think Mister considered it beneath his dignity to plan for the future. I got a pen and paper and wrote, "Anastasia, I'm running out of time, and visitors are on the way. I'm going someplace where I might be able to create new options. You will understand shortly. I'm sorry I didn't bring you too. In your condition, you'd be of limited assistance. I know you don't like it, but you also know that I'm right. Help yourself to whatever you need. I hope that we'll talk soon. Harry." I folded the note and left it on the coffee table, where she'd see it upon waking. Then I bent over, kissed her hair, and left her sleeping safe in my home. I parked the Rolls in the lot next to the marina. If we hurried, we could still get there before the witching hour, which would be the best time to try the invocation. Granted, trying it while injured and weary with absolutely no pre-ritual work was probably going to detract more than enough from the ritual to offset the premium timing. But I was beggared for time, and therefore not spoiling for choice.
"Allow me to reiterate," Murphy said, "that I feel that this is a bad idea."
"So noted," I said, "but will you do it?" She stared out the Rolls' windshield at the vast expanse of Lake Michigan, a simple and enormous blackness against the lights of Chicago.
Yes, she said. If there was anything else you could do, I said, I'd ask you to do it, I swear. I know, she said. It just pisses me off that there's nothing more I can add. Well, if it makes you feel any better, you're going to be in danger, too. Someone might decide to come by and try to use you against me. And if word gets back to the council about how much you know, they're going to blow a gasket. She smiled a bit. Yes, thank you. I feel less left out now that I know someone might kill me anyway. She shifted, settling her gun's shoulder harness a little more comfortably. I am aware of my limits. That isn't the same as liking them. She looked back at me. How are you going to reach the others? I'd really rather not say. The less you know, the safer I am. No, actually, I said. The less you know, the safer I am. Don't forget that we might be dealing with people who can take information out of your head, whether you want to give it or not. Murphy folded her arms and shivered. I hate feeling helpless. Yeah, I said. Me too. How's he doing, Molly? Still asleep, Molly reported from the back of the limo. I don't think his fever is any higher, though. She reached out and touched Morgan's forehead with the back of one hand. Morgan's arm rose up and sharply slapped her arm away at the wrist, though he never changed the pace of his breathing or otherwise stirred. Christ. It was literally a reflex action. I shook my head and said, "Let's move, people." Molly and I wrestled the wounded warden into his wheelchair again. He roused enough to help a little and sagged back into sleep as soon as he was seated. Molly slung the strap of my ritual box over her shoulder and started pushing Morgan across the parking lot to the marina docks. I grabbed a couple of heavy black nylon bags. "And what do we have in there?" Murphy asked me. "Party favors," I said. "You're having a party out there?" I turned my eyes to the east and stared out over the lake. We couldn't see the island from Chicago, even on a clear day, but I knew it was there, a sullen and threatening presence. "Yeah," I said quietly. "A real party. Practically everyone who'd wanted to kill me lately would be there." Murphy shook her head. "All of this over one man." "Over a hero of the council," I said quietly. "Over the most feared man on the wardens. Morgan nearly took out the Red King himself. A vampire maybe 4,000 years old, surrounded by some disgustingly powerful retainers. If he hadn't bugged out, Morgan would have killed him."
"You almost said something nice about him," Murphy said.
"Not nice," I said, "but I can acknowledge who he is. Morgan has probably saved more lives than you could count over the years. And he killed innocents, too. I'm certain of it. He's been the council's executioner for at least 20 or 30 years. He's obsessive and tactless and ruthless and prejudiced. He hates with a holy passion. He's a big, ugly, vicious attack dog." Murphy smiled faintly. "But he's your attack dog." "He's our attack dog," I echoed. "He'd give his life without hesitation if he thought it was necessary." Murphy watched Molly pushing Morgan down the dock.
"God, it's gotta be awful to know that you're capable of disregarding life so completely. Someone else's, yours, doesn't really matter which. To know that you're so readily capable of taking everything away from a human being, that's gotta eat away at him."
"For so long there's not a lot left, maybe," I said. "I think you're right about the killer acting in desperation. The situation got way too confused and complicated for it to be a scheme. It's just a big confluence of all kinds of chickens coming home to roost.
Maybe that will make it simpler to resolve."
"World War I was kind of the same deal," I said. "But then it was sort of hard to point the finger at any one person and say, that guy did it. World War II was simpler that way."
"You've been operating under the assumption that there is someone to blame," Murphy said.
"Only if I can catch him," I shook my head. "If I can't, well..." Murphy turned to me. She reached up with both hands, put them on the sides of my head, and pulled me down a little. Then she kissed my forehead and my mouth, neither quickly nor with passion. Then she let me go and looked up at me, her eyes worried and calm.
"You know that I love you, Harry. You're a good man, a good friend."
I gave her a lopsided smile. Don't go all gushy on me, Murph. She shook her head.
"I'm serious. Don't get yourself killed.
kick whatever ass you need to in order to make that happen. She looked down. My world would be a scarier place without you in it. I chewed my lip for a second, feeling very awkward. Then I said, I'd rather have you covering my back than anyone in the world, Karen. I cleared my throat. You might be the best friend I ever had. She blinked several times and shook her head. Okay, this is going somewhere awkward. Maybe we should take it from whatsoever ass, I suggested. She nodded. Find him. Kick his ass. That is the plan, I confirmed. Then I bent down and kissed her forehead and her mouth, gently, and leaned my forehead against hers. Love you too, I whispered. Her voice tightened. You jerk. Good luck. You too, I said. Keys are in the ignition. Then I straightened, hitched up the heavy bags, and started walking toward the docks. I didn't look at her as I walked away. I didn't look back. That way we could both pretend that I hadn't seen her crying. My brother owned an ancient, battered commercial fishing boat. He told me it was a trawler, or maybe he said troller, or schooner. It was one of those, unless it wasn't. Apparently nautical types get real specific and fussy about the fine distinctions that categorize the various vessels, but since I'm not nautical, I don't lose much sleep over the misuse of the proper term. The boat was 42 feet long and could have been a stunt double for Quint's fishing boat in Jaws. It desperately needed a paint job, as the white of its hull had long since faded to gray and smoke-smudged black. The only fresh paint on it was a row of letters on the bow, which read, Water Beetle. Getting Morgan on board was a pain, literally in his case. We got him settled onto the bed in the little cabin and brought all the gear aboard. After that, I climbed up onto the bridge, started the engines with my copy of the Water Beetle's key, and immediately realized I hadn't cast off the lines. I had to go back down to the deck to untie us from the dock. Look, I just told you. I'm not nautical. Leaving the marina wasn't hard. Thomas had a spot that was very near the open waters of the lake. I almost forgot to flick on the lights, but got them clicked on before we got out of the marina and onto the open water. Then I checked the compass next to the boat's wheel, turned us a degree or two south of due east, and opened up the engine. We started out over the blackness of the lake, the boat's engines making a rather subdued, throaty, lub-lub-dub-lub sound. The boat had originally been built for charter use in the open sea, and it had some muscle. The water was calm tonight, and the ride remained smooth as we rapidly built up speed. I felt a little nervous about the trip. Over the past year, Thomas and I had gone out to the island several times so that I could explore the place. He'd been teaching me how to handle the boat, but this was my first solo voyage. After a few minutes, Molly came partway up the short ladder to the bridge and stopped. Do I need to ask permission to come up here or something? Why would you? I asked. She considered. It's what they do on Star Trek? Good point, I said. Permission granted, Ensign. Aye, aye, she said, and came up to stand next to me. She frowned at the darkness to the east and cast a wary glance back at the rapidly fading lights of the city. So, we're going out to the weird island. The one with that big ley line running through it? Yep, I said. Where my dad got... I tried not to remember how badly Michael Carpenter had suffered when he had gone there with me. Crippled, I said. Yeah. She frowned quietly. I heard him talking to my mom about the island, but when I tried to go look it up, I couldn't find it on any of the maps, not even in the libraries. Yeah, I said. From what I hear, bad things happened to everyone who went out there. There used to be some kind of port facility for fishing and merchant traffic, big as a small town, but it was abandoned. Sometime in the 19th century, the city completely expunged the place from its records. Why? Didn't want anyone to go out there, I said. If they merely passed a law, they knew that sooner or later some moron would go there, out of sheer contrariness. So they pretty much unmade the place, at least officially. And in more than a century, no one's ever seen it? That dark ley line puts off a big field of energy, I said. It makes people nervous. Not insane or anything, but it's enough to make them subconsciously avoid the place, if they aren't making a specific effort to get there. Plus, there are stone reefs around a big portion of the island, and people tend to swing wide around it. She frowned. Couldn't that be a problem for us? I'm pretty sure I know where to get through them.
Pretty sure?
Pretty sure. Maybe she looked a little paler.
Oh, she said. Good. And we're going there, why?
The Sanctum Invocation, I said. The island has a kind of...